Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the Capital Club Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Adams. Every week, we bring on some of the brightest leaders around the world to discuss issues facing high net worth individuals and family offices today.
Hello and welcome to the Capital Club Podcast. Today, I have with me John Seaman. John is an accomplished author, historian, and entrepreneur with 20 years of experience as a consultant to organizations, families, and family enterprises. The founder and CEO of Saybrook Partners, a boutique communications and strategy advisor. He has a long record of work in family history and advisory for private clients around the world. He has also authored histories of Brown Brothers Harriman, the Mellon Foundation, beauty giant Coty, and McKinsey and Company, among others. His most recent publication is a Harvard Business Review article on managing legacy in family enterprise. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of your work, especially the Harvard Business Review article, and you have an interesting background. So I kind of want to start there. It's kind of similar, like every family, everybody who works with families has their own origin story and their own kind of genesis behind how they got to where they are. So what's yours? How did Saybrook start?
Well, I think for most of people in this space, it is a circuitous route. I started my professional life actually as an academic historian, but with a keen interest in biography. So that really encouraged me to see history through the eyes or the lens of individual experience and how people sort of make their way in the world against the larger forces shaping their opportunities and challenges. But I also spent many years working, I worked my way through graduate school, spent a lot of years working in a strategy roles for a global brokerage firm and got to understand how decisions get made in an organizational context and gave me a real appreciation about people who build businesses. And that eventually I transitioned into historical consulting, where I work with organizations to help them leverage and learn from their histories in ways that they could use to shape culture, brand, and reputation. But it was always the family enterprises that I found most fascinating. Of course, the family and generational dynamic is fascinating, worthy of an episode of Succession in many cases. And then I realized the history meant so much more to family clients than to most organizations, right? It was more personal. It was more emotional investment. There was more at stake in understanding what that story meant. And that was amply borne out by my first family history client, which was a family foundation in Geneva, which was full of lots of drama and so forth, but really was something that they came to appreciate and had value for them. So when I came to found Saybrook about 9 years ago, the reason I did so was really to help organizations and families in particular profit from their experience in some meaningful and concrete way. And we'll get to that piece in a minute. That's the professional anecdote. The personal anecdote came last year. We lost my mother after a brief illness. And as I was preparing the eulogy for her memorial service a few months later, I went back to a family history memoir that she had written over the years. And I knew it existed. And in fact, it was a running joke that whenever she, shared a family story, I said, well, be sure to add that to the Life and Times that you're writing. But the pressure of daily life, I never got around to kind of really delving into that and reading it, right? And when I lost her, I was sorry I didn't, because when I went back to it, I read her account of her relationships with her parents and her brother and her sister and their hardscrabble upbringing and all the dreams that went unrealized for lack of money and the traumas that were associated with that and how she would channel those dreams into me and to my father. And what a gift that was, I realized. And I got to know her through reading that in a way that I never had when she was alive. And it answered so many questions about my relationship with her and about my larger family. And so I think this more than anything really validated this path that I'd set out on, you know, 20 years ago, right? And really illustrated the power of family history and narrative and why wealthy families in particular, for whom there's so much more at stake, really can benefit from understanding their own family histories. So that's it in a nutshell, my path.
Yeah. And I love that anecdote and this differential line that you draw between just kind of the genealogy component versus the story that ties everything together, right? So these aren't just disparate data points. There's narratives that connect everything. And I was actually getting ready for this conversation on the way home last night. I was in New York. I was watching Ford versus Ferrari. And there's this whole storyline right on the Ford side, and really to some extent on the Ferrari side, about, you know, how that next generation will step into a leadership role. And you could look at the data points of how many cars they sell, but it doesn't really tell the whole story, right?
It tells the what, but not the why, right? And, you know, I think for whether particularly for family enterprise, but also for so many decisions facing wealthy families, it is not the what. Your advisors can help you walk through the what, but the why you're doing this, why you're engaging in the activities that you do, why you have a business, why you choose to sell a business, why you choose to distribute money in a particular way. Those are all questions that are driven by narrative and experience, and that's what family history can really get help you get at.
So what is the why for you in terms of why you do this work and what motivates you to work with families?
I think there is so much riding on this for wealthy families, right? And they have a particular, I think, a role to play in society and a particular responsibility. And the idea of helping them make better decisions, make better, more sustainable decisions, and really move beyond the what to the why is the whole purpose behind kind of helping them think through their narratives. They can be very, very therapeutic in a sense, and we'll get to that a little bit later in the conversation, but that's the why. How can we help families make better decisions in ways that are enduring and sustainable?
So what's a best practice here? We've had people come on the show before who are videographers or put together lookbooks, and there's a lot of vendors out there. But what's best practice in your opinion in terms of the right way to do this? And then what are some things that you really want to avoid if you're going to endeavor to put together a family history that has deep impact across generations?
Sure. Well, there's no one right answer. Every family's different. Every story's different. Every set of needs and requirements are different. I would say there's a huge interest, as you know, in genealogy, Ancestry.com, the TV series, Who Do You Think You Are? That I think that's there's a really felt need to kind of get in touch with your roots and your origins. And genealogy is one way to do that. Family memoir, legacy film. I know you had Jamie Younger on your show. She's terrific. And I think that sort of thing really plays a role in forging connection among generations and helping to start that conversation about where we came from, where you came from as a family. But genealogy, legacy film, in many ways, this only scratches the surface of stories that are rich, varied, complex, very deep, particularly over generations. And I think that's where the best family history comes in. It takes a deeper dive, right? There's an element of professional research, delving into papers and letters and photographs and artifacts and kind of distilling from that real compelling detail, stories that would escape or perhaps have escaped memory, but are nonetheless important and can be recovered and brought forward. There's a certain historical methodology that professional historians used in trying to look at the family history or family story first over time, how values originated, how they endured, how they had to evolve at key moments in order to be valuable to the family. Looking at change over in context, right? How our forebears and we were shaped by events and larger forces. Perhaps we shaped those events in turn. And what's distinctive and special about a family compared to other family dynasties, other family enterprises. You know, that same methodology can help recover a sense of drama and contingency, what might have happened but didn't. We tend to think of history as one march forward from event to event, but this helps us understand that we can take nothing for granted. Things might have been different, but for a different set of circumstances or decisions. And it can help us really celebrate courage, perseverance, challenges overcome, success over long odds, the kind of stories that really inspire. And ideally, and finally, it's the strategic approach, right? I think the best family history really probes the family's past for answers to questions, right? It doesn't just tell the story, but it uses that story as a starting point for the kind of conversations that need to happen among family members, among generations, about not just where they've been, but where they're going from here.
And it's really the, in my experience, the glue that keeps families together, because there has to be something more than just the money. It can't just be about this corpus of assets. And I've seen this particularly in families that have had the liquidity event. They no longer have an operating company. They no longer have this business that they can unite around and have a common shared experience around. And that's, I think, where these type of services become much more critical, is to keep that story fresh and continue that down the generations when you don't necessarily have the manufacturing firm any longer, et cetera.
Well, you know, as you and I have talked, you know, there's so many forces pulling families apart these days, right? Generational, geographic, cultural, even political and ideological in our own moment in time. And I think having an understanding of the family history and the lived experience, the values and life lessons, that's what binds families together, right? Not the money, as you say, but the values, the experience. And it helps kind of create a common identity or a cultural DNA to go with the genetic DNA that transcends any one generation, family member, or moment in time. And I think that can be very powerful. You know, you mentioned family post-liquidity. Of course, the question of ownership is a key trigger for families to think about their histories, their experience, right? Whether to sell the family business or to carry on, right? And different families will make different decisions in different contexts. But for one family that we worked with, which decided to sell the family business in its centennial year of all things, there was a lingering guilt about having done so, right? That this third generation CEO, did he fail his father by deciding to sell the business that his father had helped to build on the next level? And what we did by looking at that story was to help him understand, no, within the larger strategic context of the market at that time, and indeed within the family context, he did exactly the right thing, because this was not a family that had ever been defined by one business, one operating business. This was a family that had been defined by entrepreneurship. And so helping to understand what values they could take from that family enterprise and carry forward to new business pursuits, to philanthropic pursuits, to new opportunities, new investment opportunities with the umbrella of a new family office. These were all very powerful lessons that they could take. Of course, other families might take different decisions. And another client of ours was a global agribusiness company, and the widow of this fifth generation CEO, whose identity was very much bound up with the accomplishments of his generation. But it was through thoughtful understanding of that story, of that history, and what the family enterprise meant going all the way back to the 19th century that encouraged her to want to carry on in spite of some doubts among other family shareholders and non-family shareholders about her ability to lead that business. But she was encouraged and strengthened by understanding that family story to want to carry the business on and to see value in it. So I think understanding that story, understanding that arc, can really lead families into very different decisions, but decisions that are appropriate to them.
On the pre-call and then the notes you provided, you made a comment that I want you to expand on if possible, which is there's a temptation to see any investigation of the past as something with great sentimental value, but of little practical use. Would you mind saying more about that?
Sure. I think any family is, we're all busy with our lives. We're focused on our own careers, and there's no time for history. There's no time for the past. I'm focused on the present and the future. And to the extent that we do engage with some aspect of the past, in many cases, it's an heirloom. It's something we do later in life, perhaps, and it has sentimental value, but what relevance does it really have for the operating business, for decisions about wealth transfer, about philanthropy, about governance, about succession? And I think some of the examples I've shared today and could share, you know, the whole corpus of our work has shown that is exactly not the case. We tell a story about the past, about past generations, but how and why it's told, for whom, by whom, what we hope to achieve by it, that's a function of the present and future. And I think understanding this story can really drive meaningful and sustainable decisions about the family going forward. So many of the challenges that families face about how to pass down wealth, how to structure their estate and trust planning, whether or not to sell the family business, as we said, how we're going to kind of give back through various philanthropic pursuits. All of that is a function of decisions that have been made in the past and an experience that we as members of that family, both as individuals and as members of the family as a whole, have to come to terms with. And I'd also say that even the root causes of broken relationships or dysfunctional decision-making, all of that is a function of past experience. And we may discover by looking at it that what we're fighting over now between cousins or brother and sister has been replicating itself among our, you know, all the way up back to our grandparents and great-grandparents. And that frees us and empowers us to choose a different path forward.
So I'm a child of the 80s, and there's been this onslaught of, it's kind of hard to say if they're documentaries or puff pieces or just PR for themselves, but like Schwarzenegger, I watched the Stallone one recently. Why do you think there is this trend happening now, this capturing of these stories, this reflection back? And how are you saying that play out within the multigenerational family space?
I think there's a hunger for understanding where we came from. It's the same impulse toward genealogy and all of that. I think there's a hunger for understanding who we are and where we came from and what that means. And it can be done in a very self-aggrandizing and superficial way, as some of these documentaries are. Or it can be done in a very thoughtful way. And in some cases, the power of family history is precisely that it is private. As soon as you start going public and looking at a wider audience, looking at the employees of your family enterprise or a wider audience, you begin to shrink from being honest, from honesty and candor and transparency, and you begin to want to shape the narrative in some PR-friendly way. Whereas having the freedom to talk about these stories privately among your family members can actually empower much more thoughtful and meaningful reflections that have value in terms of where the family and the family business is going.
Exceptional family offices, family enterprises, wealth management, and financial services organizations require superior leadership to successfully thrive in today's competitive environment. This is why I'd like to introduce you to our new sponsor, Mac International. Mac International is recognized as the premier boutique firm that specializes in providing retained executive search and strategic human capital consulting solutions to single and multi-client family offices, family enterprises, and the full spectrum of wealth management advisory, investment management, and financial services firms that serve ultra-high net private investors and family offices on a national and international basis. If you're interested in learning more about Mac International, visit their website at macinternational.com.
So who tends to be the initiator here in your experience?
Well, increasingly family representatives of the family, right? The family, you know, single family office or a multifamily office, other wealth managers, a family advisor. If you think about some of the decisions facing wealthy families, it can become exhausting. And people can become disengaged from it. And I think a lot of family advisors that we've worked with, family offices, see engaging with the family history really as a way to energize and re-engage client families in the mission of what they're doing. And they begin to see value and see clarity in how they're going to do their trusts and estate planning, how they're going to make these important decisions. The most common person coming to commission a project like this is still the older generation, right? They want to pass on a legacy of values and life lessons. Trusts and shareholders agreements and so forth really are another way of storytelling about the values that helped me as a patriarch or a matriarch of the family succeed, and how I hope that you, my son or daughter, or my grandchildren or descendants will succeed as well. But too often, I think an older generation will see their heirs merely as stewards or caretakers, right? They're given an inheritance, entrusted with the family business, and then they're charged with not frittering it away or screwing up. And when it's framed like this, a legacy, even the most fulsome legacy, can begin to feel more like a burden than a gift. And so we often proceed from the idea that a legacy is not just transmitted, but it's also received, and it has to be received in order for it to carry forward from one generation to the next. So if the older generation in many ways is the most common source of these kinds of projects, then the rising generation is in many ways the most important. They want to carry on the family legacy, but they also want to identify family values that resonate for them. And they also, in some cases, want to reimagine those values for their own time and place. They need to see in that history and to find a way to have permission to go in new directions, either leading the family enterprise or transforming the family enterprise in ways that make sense to them, to uncover previously overlooked stories and insights from the family past that can inspire, you know, new entrepreneurial gambits of their own, to shape an authentic rebranding of the enterprise. And so part of the kind of consulting that we do and that family history consulting in the best sense, I think, should do is to help older generations really make room for the next generation and help next generations find and make their own place in the story.
How do you manage the skeletons in the closet? You know, if you go digging and then you find some buried bodies, what's best practices there?
So, of course, you know, many families will avoid grappling with their history in the first place because they know it means grappling with some difficult episodes, marital infidelity, divorce, mental health struggles, substance abuse, scandal. And for some long-lived family enterprises, particularly in Europe, it could mean, well, in this country, it could mean involvement with slavery, it could mean forced labor, even Nazi-era crimes. And so there's good reasons not to deal with that, to kind of put this aside and let's focus on the present and future. And in fact, there are really good reasons to really face up to confront difficult pasts. The cover-up, of course, is always worse than the crime. And your descendants will find it hard to forgive you for suppressing and whitewashing something they later discover about themselves and about their family. And if you're a notable family or a family enterprise, public profile, well, if you don't tell your story, someone else will, and it may not be on the terms that you would tell. It can be hard to come to terms with this, right? And this is where the generational divide comes into play. Older generations might be particularly connected to and feel invested in their story, in the family story, because they were the ones who helped to build that. But for children, one generation removed, they tend to have a little more critical distance and more willing to cast a critical eye on past missteps. One of my favorite examples of this is, and this is public knowledge, so it's needn't be masked, and this is the Reimann family in Germany. They're one of Germany's wealthiest families, and they're majority owners of Benckiser and various assets going back to Benckiser, a German chemical and industrial company. And a few years ago, the third generation discovered, well, they always knew that they were products of an affair between their father, who led Benckiser in the 1940s, 30s and 40s, and a Jewish employee. They knew that their mother's father was murdered by the Nazis during the Holocaust. But what they didn't know until they commissioned some historical research was that their father and their grandfather had been Nazi sympathizers who had employed forced labor in the company. Third generation was inclined to ignore this. They felt it was just too difficult to get around. But the fourth generation, with the support of non-family leaders in the enterprise, forced the issue. And so they recommitted the family foundation to combating anti-Semitism and supporting liberal values, liberal democratic values. And they renamed the foundation after their mother's murdered father, Alfred Landecker, and so used his name as kind of a narrative driver for a different kind of future than their own family had embraced. And so I think that's a really terrific example of how a difficult past is not just a source of guilt or shame, something to kind of have to suffer through, but it can actually be a motivator or a narrative driver for a different kind of transformation the family wants to make.
What are some other common potholes that people step in here? Maybe if you're initiating this process or conversation internally and you're trying to help look around some possible corners, are there other issues that maybe people don't think of initially that come up during this process?
I think a lot of people are not prepared, first of all, for the commitment of time that this sort of thing takes. It's not as though you can kind of go commission somebody from the outside and they'll come back in a year or two with something that more or less may or may not meet your needs and be what you anticipated. It requires a level of commitment of time to the enterprise that can be a little difficult for busy people to get their heads around. It also requires an emotional commitment. Beginning to see your story unfold, to learn some things that might be uncomfortable, and to have or to invite someone from the outside into your full into the family fold, and to make them privileged to, in some cases, some very intimate details, can be a little jarring. And I think that's why it's important for families to think very carefully about whom it is they engage, and that this person should be someone they trust or can trust or begin to trust over time and trust that they will deal with these kinds of issues, the good and the bad, in a sensitive, thoughtful, discreet manner. I think that's extraordinarily important for—
What are some questions that people should ask if they do an RFP or rely on some referrals and introductions to family historian folks? What would be your rubric when you kind of preliminarily speak with these type of people?
For the people that I engage as partners or for what or family should—
If a family is looking into doing one of these exercises and they're interviewing people?
I would look certainly first at the credentials of the people involved. You know, professional training counts, and it means that the quality of the product, at least at a foundational level, is going to be higher. I would look at the kind of work that they've done before, be sure that the tone of that work, the rigor of that work, the quality of that work is as high as any family should expect. But that also it's in the same vein as what they might expect. You know, family might be looking at a really kind of rigorous piece of work at a very high level of depth, but they may also be looking at something much more engaging and accessible. And so finding the right partner with the right set of skills. And I think checking references is vitally important because, you know, as I say, having someone that you trust with these kinds of aspects of your story, that's vitally important. And finding someone who is able to kind of deal with them in a productive, forward-looking way is also important.
So I've had Jamie, you alluded to Jamie, and I've had some other really talented people come on here. And obviously people interpret and digest information in different modes and means. What are the approaches you're seeing families take in terms of multimedia, right? We've got the traditional, the lookbooks, the photo albums, but how are people incorporating video or social media or other types of kind of multimodal experiences?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, we're all consuming information in different ways these days. I think there is actually still value in a full-on book-length treatment of the family history or some part of that family history. In some ways, you know, print is not dead, and that there's a certain prestige or even gravitas associated with print as we move forward in the digital world. But I think it's important to create narratives that people will actually consume, right? To meet them where they are. And we've begun to, as we've begun to consume content differently, family history has changed. So increasingly, you know, what we're doing is a lot of compact, purpose-built narratives geared towards specific decisions or challenges. In some ways, almost a consulting exercise. We worked recently with one family enterprise around their approaching their 75th anniversary, and knowing that they were beginning to think about a conversation, potentially a very emotional conversation about whether to sell the business. Well, we use that opportunity to kind of understand, you know, the family and the change in the business over time, not just the origin story and how selling the business could really, you know, fit into the next chapter. And also kind of distilling some values that we could or they could reimagine for a different religious and cultural context as, you know, some of the family households were no longer quite as aligned to the original religious faith as earlier members had done. So there's, you know, I think there's an internal consulting piece. A lot of how families are dealing with family history is more in the family meeting space, facilitated dialogue. You know, I think it's really important, you know, when we're kind of documenting a family history, that it not just sit on a shelf or sit on a hard drive somewhere, that it actually be out there. It not simply be received passively, but then it be actively discussed in dialogue so that family members can understand what it means to them. I think a lot of larger families, you know, particularly family enterprises, of certain size or larger multi-generational families will, you know, sometimes invest in a family archive that can then become public or not, or some sort of small museum or exhibit, private podcasting. And I think as many in this space becomes you documentary film and video. There's no one answer. Every family will have difficult, particular needs, particular audiences they need to reach. I think legacy film, for example, is potentially a more intimate and personal way to engage with this sort of thing. But by definition, it is also limited to the current generation who are living and are able to speak. And in some ways, if we want to remember or imagine the older generations at the height of their powers, that can be risky if the person who is then at an advanced age or in a frail state. So there are different, I think, circumstances that suggest different outputs. I think what's important, and this is, you know, what I've said a moment ago, is to have sort of these thoughtful preliminary conversations experienced consultants about, you know, why are we doing this? What do we hope to achieve with this particular project? Who's the audience? And what's the format best suited to reach them?
I was in Dallas recently for a family office kind of event, and it was across the street from the Perot Museum. And obviously the old Park Lane Hospital has some incredible archives. What are you seeing? And are you seeing actual families putting together? You mentioned they're approaching things differently. Bricks and sticks type archival setups for museums these days, or is that out of vogue?
No, I think so. It has long been very popular in Europe. There are a lot of large, old family enterprises in Europe who have long, they see themselves as having a public role to play. In some cases, their histories are a national treasure, and they see themselves as having an obligation to open their doors and to share those stories and the papers and the resources and the artifacts with a public audience. And so that makes sense for them. You know, whether it makes sense for a smaller family enterprise, for a notable family of some kind, I think that's a decision they have to make. But I think there are ways to do it. You know, there's something, you know, if you've been to any of the great museums here in Europe, anywhere in the world, there's something really tactile. There's something very satisfying about kind of getting in touch with a particular object or a particular piece of paper, or a particular photograph, something that you can put your hands on. It's extremely meaningful. And I think it's another powerful way of kind of commuting that story, particularly if it's a family enterprise and you want to engage with your non-family employees. They too need to understand and hear this story and understand what it means for them.
Well, John, I want to thank you so much for coming on. This has been tremendous. For all our listeners, please do leave us a rating and commentary about what your favorite part of the conversation was. Before I let you go, John, any good biographies in particular? What are your favorites? I'm always out there looking for some good book recommendations. You referenced that earlier.
Good biographies. I'm a big fan of Ron Chernow and David McCullough. I think you go to the author who's going to be engaging with this sort of thing in a thoughtful, meaningful way. Those are my favorites.
Terrific. And a question we ask everyone that comes on the show, do you have a daily practice that helps bring peace to your life?
I do, and it involves around family. I came late to marriage and fatherhood, and I've appreciated it all the more as a result. So we have two rituals every day. My wife and I, at the end of the day, will find a time, usually in the kitchen, to sit down and talk about our days, as no matter how things kind of crazy have gotten. And bedtime with our two boys is also pretty therapeutic as well. So I think those kind of things are what brings me peace at the end of a busy day.
Thank you for sharing. And thank you again for coming on and joining us. If people are interested in learning more about the work you're doing, what's the best way for them to engage with you?
Visit our website, sabredpartners.com, or our LinkedIn page, where we're pretty active as well.
Well, John, thank you again for joining us, and I look forward to staying in touch.
Ryan, thanks so much. Cheers.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.